Welcome to the Chamber Podcast. I'm Dan Harrison, and this episode comes to you from Edgbaston Cricket Ground, a venue our two special guests know very well. And we're going to be talking about The Greatest Season, a new book documenting Warwickshire County Cricket Club's treble-winning exploits of 1994. I'm delighted to be joined by the book's author, renowned BBC sport broadcaster Pat Murphy, and a man who took 81 wickets during that history-making season, former Warwickshire bowler Tim Munton. So, Pat, you covered the Bears' exploits during that season in which they won the Benson Hedges Cup, the Sunday League title and the County Championship. So just set the scene of the book.
First of all, Dan, I'm delighted at the use of the word renowned. Thank you very much for that. The check's in the post. Personally, it was a great summer because I was doing either for the new Radio 5 Live, which had just started that summer. I was either doing Test Match Cricket, England playing South Africa, or I was following the Bears. And that was no hardship for me, having been part of the furniture really since about 1974 when I moved to Pebble Mill just down the road. I used to walk down the road and spend some time talking to Dennis Amers, David Brown, Bob Willis and co, became friends with them. Saw the young shavers coming through, people like Tim Munton, Andy Lloyd, Gladstone Small, godfather Gladstone's first son, for example, Zachary. So it was all a nexus of professional involvement, but also massive personal involvement. And it was a tremendously nostalgic summer for me in terms of the fact that I can't remember having a happier working summer than that one. And you try to detach yourself as much as you possibly can while assessing the professional worth. And 25 years on, I sat down and thought, how good were they? And the answer has to be tremendous and probably the best county side in terms of achievement. Now, there have been better county sides in terms of top quality players. But if you look at a 40-year span when four trophies were available, only in that 40-year period, no one comes close to Warwickshire. Gloucestershire won three one-day titles in 1 year, 2000. But they didn't win the Blue Riband, the county championship. Any pro will tell you the Blue Riband, the county championship, is the one. And Warwickshire won it in 94 plus two others. In fact, Warwickshire, Dan, won six trophies in 24 months from September 93 to September 95. I would suggest that makes them a fairly tasty side. So I'm quite happy to stick my neck out and say it was the greatest season. Statistically, I'm not saying they were the greatest county side ever, but statistically they were.
Well, the record books certainly stack that up. And I know you've spoken to a hell of a lot of people when putting this book together. And the big dilemma was which anecdotes to leave out.
Yeah, I couldn't shut Munton up, for example, as you'll probably find out very, very quickly. To me, it was very important. There were two separate areas that had to be covered. And I talked about 30 opposition players. I think assessing the professional respect from other counties was very important because Warwickshire weren't popular. But the fact is there was a lot of professional respect for them. So I talked to lots and lots of cronies from other counties who I've kept in touch with. But also I wanted to talk to backroom people, not just the players. I wanted to talk to a guy called Keith Cook, who's just Mr. Warwickshire, who's Mr. Fixer, who's been there all the time, still is. I wanted to talk to Dennis Amers, his first year as chief executive, hot seat that one. I wanted to talk to Stuart Nottingham, the physio, the man who got people like Gladstone Small and Tim Munton on the field, which is no mean achievement. Roy French, the warm, friendly, gregarious dressing room attendant, and his son Robin has now picked up the mantle. So it's important to talk to the dressing room attendant and also Steve Rouse, the groundsman. He won a county championship medal for Warwickshire in 1972, and there he was his first year as head groundsman in 1994. So I wanted to get an all-round picture of the club as it was at that time. Without being too pompous and too Sunday supplementish, Dan, I think it's a case of the anatomy of a club. How's that for a Ponzi observation?
Well, as an aside, actually, Stuart Nottingham now works with one of our chamber patrons, BHSF, in their physiotherapy department. So anyway, it was an extraordinary season to report on, nevertheless. So what was it like to play in, Tim?
Best year of my life, probably. I mean, that's when you look back on a year like that, and thanks to Pat's book, it's something we've been able to talk about over the last few months, and really, really looking forward to seeing the book, because it's been a journey of sort of 4 or 5 months of remembering some of the fondest memories of our lives. And I think as a bunch of players to have had the opportunity that we had to play professional sport together, but then to have played together in that particular season where three trophies were won, was fantastic.
If I may say so, Dan, Tim's input has been very important because I've shown the manuscript to him at various stages. It was really important that I had talked to somebody I respected who could actually give me the real unvarnished reaction. I said, I'm not going to alter my slant and my perception of the situation, but Tim picked up one or two things that were really important that he corrected me on, and I probably reminded him about, but one or two things he'd forgotten about.
There was definitely a lot of that. There was plenty I'd forgotten about. And again, that's the fun of the journey as well. It's sort of, you know, when you're talking to Pat and talking to the players, that we've all started talking for the first time in detail, if you like, for many years, about what went on in 94. And, you know, there's plenty you remember fondly and vividly, but there's a few things that you've put at the back of the mind, if you like, that when you bring them forward are either a little bit cringeable in some areas, but also very fond as well.
Aren't you planning a celebratory dinner at some stage, Tim? And if so, will it be a two-day event?
the club are putting something together, which is going to happen later on in August, where the hope is that we get hopefully all of the guys, and that it's unlikely that we will get everybody, but hopefully we can try and get as many of the guys together, to celebrate and have some time together, but also then to sort of share some stuff with the members and the guys around one of the big 2020 games is the plan.
Yeah, I mean, that dinner could go on longer than an innings by a certain batsman who we're going to talk about a bit later on. But I mean, it really ranks as one of the greatest achievements in cricket, if not British sport. So at what point in the season did you go, hang on a second, we've got a chance to do something really, really special here?
I think the point when we thought we could genuinely compete very well in all the competitions was probably about halfway through the season. But I'd say this time of year, when you're into March, April, every single county in the country is talking about how they're going to win every trophy because you're planning to do it. And I think when you piece together, if you like, Pat alluded to the 1993 final that we won at Lords against Sussex, the NatWest final. If you start from that point where we won a game that very few thought possible, probably if we're all honest, including us in the dressing room, we had a positive plan of how do we chase down 321 runs. But having achieved that's parked in your memory banks that you know, no game's lost, if you like. You can always come back. And then, obviously, during the course of the winter, we'd signed Manoj Prabhakar to come as our overseas pro. He sadly picked up an injury. Sadly for him, and you know, in retrospect, great for the club, because we then turned attention to Brian Lara. And Brian coming over on the back of breaking the Test World record, the euphoria, the attention, the buzz and the hype that came right at the start of the season. We then had sort of two chunks, if you like, before we'd even played a game of cricket, that then kicked into it. So the momentum then builds. And to be fair, middle of the season, Benson's final, well positioned in the championship and doing okay in the Sunday league.
And do you know how much Lara cost, Dan? They signed him just before he got his 375, the world record test match score. £40,000 contract. MJ K. Smith, chairman, Dennis Ames, chief executive, Tony Cross, vice chairman, played a blinder there, because I'm indebted to Keith Cook for the information that membership soared so much after the signing of Lara, that they passed the £40,000 he paid Lara threefold. So the members, the new member subscriptions, paid for Lara's salary threefold in 1994. They should be on bargain hunt, that group of Warwickshire executives.
Absolutely. Don't tell Brian's agents at the time.
Tell us about the input of the two men at the top, the Dermot Reeve, the captain, and also the late Bob Woolmer, who just had a phenomenal cricketing brain, didn't he?
Yeah, I'd say the reason we were successful in that era goes way back before that. I mean, I joined the club in 1985, and sort of 85 to 90, if you like, was a period where my generation, I was one of probably seven or eight players under the initial guidance of David Brown and Norman Gifford as manager and captain, and when we first started. But then a significant chunk, if you like, in our personal development was under Andy Lloyd and Bob Cottam as a coach and captain combination. And so when Andy retired and Dermot took over the captaincy, Bob had been with us for a year before that. I think it was a year he'd been in, and I was asked to do the vice captain's role as well. So the build up to 94 was sort of significant in what had gone on before it. So in terms of where Bob is absolutely ahead of his time, and sort of, you know, a lot of what you see now in world cricket in terms of coaching techniques and the science that's involved in the game, he was sort of the forebearer of that, if you like. He brought that into the game. And Dermot was just particularly in one day cricket, the most challenging dynamic brain that there was around at the time. And so you put those two together, and I had the lovely title of Captain Sensible because I sat with the man in the middle, if you like, sometimes sort of just watching and observing the two of them sort of discussing different aspects of the game. And so we had a good solid bunch of players. Pat rightly says we weren't the best county team ever. We put the scores on the board and the results that show we had the best season ever. But a lot of that was down to a mixture of slow built talent, if you like, in sort of over the previous 5 or 6 years to be solid county players. We knew what we were doing. And then this magic mixture of Bob Warmer and Dermot Rees' brains and challenging the old way of thinking, which we were lucky enough to sort of be on the back of that.
I think, Dan, Warwickshire's success is an interesting module, if you like, for your chamber members in terms of how you actually create a successful business or enterprise, because you had the forward planning that Tim referred to. You had the boldness. You had the camaraderie. You had instant executive decisions, for example, going out on the limb and signing Lara. And by the way, siphoning off Prabhakar ruthlessly. They paid them off, but they made it quite clear, sorry, man, Ash, that's it. And then they brought in Lara, plus a bit of luck. And also Tim is minimising his contribution as Captain Sensible, because there were times when the train could have been derailed during that summer. You can't have highly talented, motivated, confident people in any workforce operating cheek by jowl for 5 months without tensions, problems, jealousies, various rivalries. That is inevitable. So there's no point, and I haven't in the book, glossing over any of that. It wasn't Pangloss and everything else. There were problems, not least of all between Lara and Reeve. But Dennis Amos, Tim, Bob Warmer managed to keep the ship on an even keel right up until the end of September. So in terms of running a successful business, I think there are a lot of elements from Warwickshire's success that people could tap into about doing the right thing at the right time and taking executive action and being bold and brave. Then at times, hunkering down, keeping quiet and just riding out the storm, and it worked magnificently.
That must have been part of the joy of writing the book, not just the success on the field, but some real characters in there.
There were Dermot Rees. I've wrote Dermot Rees' autobiography for him, Winning Ways. Tremendous character. Gladstone, one of my oldest friends. Dear old Glad. He loved a kip. He had three children under the age of five in those days. And Gladstone's room, the physio's couch. Tim's smiling now because everybody does when they talk about Glad. Glad would only stay awake when Warwickshire were batting, when Brian Lara was batting. Everybody knew that. Then he'd go off and go back to sleep. But everybody knew. You only had to look at the player's dining room to look in the window. And if Gladstone was there, you then look left and Lara was batting. But there were some tremendous guys in that side as well. Keith Piper was one of the great wicketkeepers of my time. Dominic Osler, fantastic all-round fielder. Blue supporter, Birmingham City supporter, Gladstone, Aston Villa supporter, a lot of rivalry there. Roger Toos, very underrated cricketer, went off to New Zealand at the end of 95, played international cricket for the Kiwis. Intelligent man. I believe he would have been Warwickshire's captain as well, subsequently, along with Tim Munton. But a lot of really interesting guys. Sadly, Dickie Davis died of a brain tumour 10 years later. He was a very, very valuable member of that side as well. And Sam, his wife, still keeps in touch with a lot of the people here at the club. It was a very interesting nexus of characters. They weren't robots. They all had things to say. They're all different characters. And the job of people like Tim and Dermot Reeve and Dennis Amos and Bob Warmer was just to sort of keep a lid on some of the volatility while at the same time making sure that they could breathe and flourish and do their best under testing circumstances on the field.
I think something that, I mean, drawing the analogies, if you like, between the sporting dressing room and business is quite interesting. And one of the other big things that team had, because we've been built together over a period of time, the leadership wasn't restricted to the captain, the vice captain, and the coach, and the chief executive. You know, we had strong leaders throughout the dressing room. Pat's just alluded to Gladstone and Andy Moles and Neil Smith, Roger Toos. They were all sharp brains, and you know, they were leaders in their own right. So whilst we didn't have the best talent, we had good enough talent, and it was embraced and harnessed in a way that you know, history tells us that we weren't bad, and we got the results that we got because of, not just because brilliant cricketers were there, batters and bowlers, but as a collective, we came together in a really special way.
And people were quite snooty on the county circuit, Dan, in that first half hour, perhaps in that first two-thirds of the season, before it suddenly dawned on them, yeah, Lancashire are good, of course they are, Surrey are good, Leicestershire, wow, Nottinghamshire, yeah, they're all good sides, good players. But suddenly I think it dawned collectively, oh, blankety blank, the Bears are going to do it. And they came up through the blind side, came round Tattenham Corner and breasted the tape with great style. And they took a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, I think when you draw those analogies, and it's sort of with how other teams were more sort of more fancied, if you like, and more fashionable in terms of the talent within them. The other bit as a player, though, when you sort of, and we've all got our friends from that era, both within our own dressing room, but sort of the opposition as well. And the bits that were quite sort of, they're impactful, if you like, is when you saw your pals. A few of us had been on England, in my case, England A tours, B tours, and you sort of get to know the opposition players. And you almost see them defeated as they walk in the dressing room telling you how good you are. You think, that's a really interesting sort of psychology, if you like, that here we are. We're feeling confident. We're working hard. We're not taking anything for granted. But our opposition are coming through sort of telling us how good we are. And that sort of almost transfer, if you like, of sort of the pressure to the actual patting us on the back and bigging us up without really realising that what they were doing. We all talked about that. It was quite interesting. You sort of pass a comment that, I don't know, Ian Salisbury's a great mate of mine, and you know, he'd come up and sort of say, oh God, you've won another five in a row or whatever it is, that sort of comment, it's the reflective sort of boost that gives you as well. And you know, we hung on to it for a couple of years.
That's why I wanted to get that separate chapter of tributes from all the pros around the circuit. And during that period after that, 95 and 96, other players from other counties were sidling up to Dermot Reeve, you know, Tim, saying, I'd like to come and play here at Edgbaston. You know, it was amazing how the amount of other teams started to copy Warwickshire. James Whittaker, when they won the championship in 96, said they used Warwickshire as a prototype. Lancashire, who were always at your throat, started to use some of your warm-up procedures before the game started. And a lot of players from other counties suddenly thought, wow, what's going on here at Warwickshire now? But mind you, Tim Munton's been very, very modest. You no doubt, Dan, will come up with the stats here now about the fact that he took 81 wickets. He was an outstanding player. Forget Lara. And he was also one of Woodson's five cricketers of the year. So I think you should tickle him up and get him to talk about himself.
Yeah, I think only Courtney Walsh took more wickets that season. Is that right?
I don't. I'm not a stats man. He'll sort of fluff it off. But it was my best season. And you know, when I look back on it with great collective pride, if you like, in terms of being part of the team. But it, you know, I do look back on it personally, knowing that I had my best cricket season in 1994, which coincided with winning a load of trophies. What influences what? You can't do it without other players around you.
And one of Wisden's five cricketers of the year, which is an honour that all you players covet.
Absolutely. I'm 25 years on, it feels like yesterday, by the way, but it's sort of when you do start churning it. And again, there's a closeness between Pat and I for lots of reasons. And it was Pat that told me, because he wrote the foreword, if you like, for the Wisden Almanac that year. So in terms of being selected and it all follows on, if you like, in terms of part of that. It's amazing memories, and that's, you know, that's what it's about.
Dan, I told Tim about this in the Warwickshire dressing room in September 1994, and I said, magisterially, I said, now, Tim, you've got to keep quiet about this because it comes out in April. It'll not be announced until April next year that you're one of Wisden's five cricketers of the year, so we've got to do the article, so let's sit down and start talking about it. You know what he said? Can I tell me dad? I said, you know, I think that'll be all right, Tim. Now, why was that, Tim?
Well, in the nicest possible way, it really is one of those things that you the respect for the title and the award, if you like, in a cricketer's mind. And I suppose in my own way, if I'd have told my dad, I might have not stopped at my dad. But it's sort of, you're keeping it quiet. I think I probably did tell him, to be fair, but it was one of those, it was the perfect icing on the cake, if you like, to what was a magical year. And that's personally and collectively. And the memories that come back, and I say, going through the chats with Pat for the chapters about me, but also having a chance to have a look over some of the other chapters he's written as well. It's sort of things you forget about. And it's just sort of brilliant hearing what Trevor Penny thinks about the 94 season, the innings with Lara, and go on, here we go.
There's some good quiz questions in that as well. Tim knows the answer to this one, but which of those Warwickshire players, he played in the Sunday League that year that Warwickshire won, which of those Sunday players appeared as a stand-in actor in the Christmas edition of Only Fools and Horses, 1996? Don't you know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to that.
1996, Only Fools and Horses, Christmas edition, watched by over 20 million people, Michael Bell. Michael Bell, one of the coolest dudes I've ever known in cricket. You didn't know that, Tim.
I didn't.
His dad worked in the Caribbean section of the BBC down at Pebble Mill, where I worked. And the Only Fools and Horses production team got in touch with him and said, can you get us some extras? I said, what about my son? He's a good-looking boy and a cool dude. And as Dominic Osler said to me, he said, I've never known a cooler dude in cricket than Michael Bell. Never had creases in his trousers. Never put his mobile or keys or coins in his pocket. You know, he looked like
an immaculate breeze. He was everything.
Breeze, his nickname was Breeze because he breathed through it. Anyway, Michael got the gig, and he said for Peckham Reed, Bristol City's car park. Went down there for a day, strolled around, and I said, I thought I'd end up on the cutting room floor, but I'm there halfway through. I said, did you get paid? I did get paid. And how typical, the wheel has come full circle. Breeze, Michael Bell, just an immaculate dresser. He now has a clothes shop in Brighton.
That doesn't surprise me. He's definitely someone I'm looking forward to catching up with through the course of the summer. But no, brilliant.
And which family played county cricket? Four members of the same family played county cricket. One of them was the 94 group.
Listen, if I'd known I was coming for a quiz, I'd have read up a bit more. Go on, you'll have to tell me.
Paul Smith, and his two brothers, and his dad played for Leicestershire. So there's lots and lots of quiz questions stem from all of that. Who got the slowest double century in the history of county cricket? Andy Moles at Guildford.
Now, it's impossible to discuss that great season without mentioning the name Brian Charles Lara. And that innings against Durham. First of all, I mean, you must have spent a hell of a long time in the pavilion watching him over the course of that match. So just tell us about it from your perspective.
It was, again, as a many highlights of the whole year, but to sort of, I mean, you talk about talent, that we as a collective were probably not the most talented, but we had what's been proven in the annals of history, one of the most talented batsmen of all time as part of our team. And his first 6 to 8 weeks were just, they were unbelievable when you sort of look at what he achieved. And sort of to, in the middle of all that, to score the world record score of 501 and being in the dressing room and sort of around that. Gladstone definitely didn't sleep much during that match. But it was spread over 4 days, in effect, because it was at a time when we played 3 days of the four-day county championship, broke off to play the Sunday league game and then finish off on the Monday. So his first part of his innings, I think he was 111 not out on the Friday night. It rained all day Saturday. We played the Sunday league game and he turns up on the Monday morning. And for one of the very rare occasions, he was first in the nets, putting right some of his techniques that had gone a little bit awry on the Friday. Again, something that's probably not best understood about Brian. You know, brilliant natural talent, but most people wouldn't be aware of the work and the hours he put in and sort of how much of the professional he really was in that space. And then to sort of watch him score. I mean, again, when I look back on this now, you realise how amazing it was, because it had been a two-hour session the final day of the season, of the match, sorry, and he scored 174 runs in that morning session to be 285 not out, and I may be out by one or two on these numbers, but 285 not out at lunch. And then to have the confidence, or if you like, to sort of actually for him to start thinking, I can break the record. And, you know, he came in at lunchtime and I was sat with Bob Warmer, God bless him, talking, and we were chatting through about what we were going to do in the afternoon. We'd had a chat with Dermot. We were going to declare, because the bonus points had been played for, and maybe go and get our overrate up. And Brian came behind us and sort of said, McLaren 425, the county record. I had no idea. Bob thought, he said, yeah, I think so. He said, Muhammad 499, the world record. To which Bob, who was a nine-year-old, had actually watched Mohammed score his 501, or 499, sorry. And he just went, yep. And Brian said, I want to go for it. I want to go for the record. Now, it wasn't arrogance. It was just, he had a feeling, the opportunity was in front of him. There was two sessions left of a game to go and score, maths aren't very good, but 216 or whatever it is in the rest of the day to get to his 501. And he'd obviously got it in his head he could do it. He wasn't expecting to do it, but he knew he could do it. So we said, go and have a chat with Dermot. I'm sure while you're at the crease, we'll carry on batting. The rest is history, as they say. Sort of partnerships with Trevor Penny and Keith Piper, which tend to get overlooked or forgotten about a bit. And Keith Piper whispering in his ear with three balls of the last over, which it would have been to go. You're on 497, you've got three balls. strokes the ball through the covers for four, and as they say, the rest is history.
Talk about quiz questions. You know what I'm going to say now. The name. Well, no, but the name Chris Scott comes up in the book in terms of opposition players that you've spoken to. The man probably responsible for one of the most costliest errors in the history of sport.
And Chris Scott was absolutely charming when I talked to him. I tracked him down. He's now a coach in Oxford. And I'd forgotten this. I was in and out of the dressing room, with the Durham dressing room, because I was very good friends with Jeff Cook and David Graveney. And David Graveney had gone in the fetlock the day before. He couldn't bowl, so they were a bowler short, Durham. And he was looking very, very sheepish. But Chris Scott, in the dressing room that night, he dropped him on 18, right? Simple as that. And I said to Chris, look, I gave him some historical examples of wicketkeepers dropping clangers over the years. And I said, come on, Chris, tomorrow's another day, blah, blah, blah. And when I talked to him a few months ago, he said, I've never forgotten that. He said, because I felt so low. He said, it hit me even more the next day. And when you at the end of the over, this is where the quote came from. He uttered a few Anglo-Saxon expletives because it was regulation, Nick, in and out. And he's a good keeper, Chris Scott. Yeah. He was a very useful batsman too. And this affected his career. He's told me this subsequently, because his career ended early. He said he couldn't get out of his system because people kept reminding him about it, which was just a bit harsh. He said to Wayne Larkins while they're walking up the other end, I bet you'll go and score 100 now. So he didn't just score 100, he scored 501, not out. But Chris was charming about that. And I thought, he represents the very best kind of county cricketer who can actually talk about that with such maturity 25 years on, because it hurt him. The best line, though, from Durham was from Johnny Morris, who fine batsman, who Tim and I know well. Johnny was a good batsman, played for England, but he wasn't much of a bowler, a bustling medium pacer. Because it was short, he had to come on and bowl a few overs near the end, which helped Lara get towards 501, not out. So he thought, oh, to hell with this. I'm going to bowl him a bouncer in the final over. Clanged him on the helmet. Lara hit on the helmet by Morris, the medium-paced trundler. Morris thought that was hilarious. He said to me when I interviewed him about it, he said, you know, I'm the only cricketer in first-class history to hit somebody on the helmet when they're 497 not out. He said, while we're at it, I scored a double 100 on the first day, and no one ever talks about my double 100 for Durham on day one. They talk about Lara.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, just going back to the Scotty scenario, he's actually unlucky, because if Anderson Cummings hadn't bowled a no-ball when Lara was on 12, he wouldn't have had the chance of dropping the catch. So he was actually out, could have been out twice before he got to 20. And I don't believe there was another chance after that, but twice before 20.
Believe it or not, Michael Burns, who was on the staff at the time, Lara's about 130-odd, Michael Burns dropped him at square leg.
Did he drop him? I knew that. I was trying to recount this earlier. I remember a ball going close to him. I didn't know whether he dropped him, but there we are.
Don't spoil the story,
Tim. No, I won't. Of course, cut that bit out.
Okay, and just to wrap up then, Pat, the book, it's out in April. When and where can you get hold of it?
It's published on April the 11th, Dan. There'll be a special evening here for the Warwickshire members, where it's going to be launched. And Tim's with me the two nights before, April the 9th. We're talking to Warwickshire Cricket Society here at Edgbaston, so everybody's welcome to that. Tim, myself, and Neil Smith, who was always also tremendously helpful with the book. His dad, MJK, was a terrific Warwickshire player as well, and captain. So that's April the 9th, and it comes out on April the 11th, launched here. You can get it in, quote, all good bookshops, Amazon and all the rest of it. That night, we've got a great turnout, and I'm really sorry that Tim can't be there. That night, talking about the book, there'll be Dermot Reeve, Gladstone Small, Dominic Osler, Graham Welch, who were all part of the team, obviously, in those days. We've got Asif Din, who was in and out of the side, who had that great 100 that won the NatWest the year before. We've also got Alan Donald, the great Alan Donald, because Alan was there or thereabouts during that summer because he's with the South African touring side. Kent are playing on that day, and Alan's with Kent now as coach, so he's going to pop in. Ian Bell, who's written the foreword, he was 12 at the time. Ian Bell said that Warwickshire side inspired him to be a professional cricketer. So Ian, he's struggling with an injury at the moment. He'll not be playing for Warwickshire that day. He's going to come in as well. I'm sorry if I've forgotten anybody else, but I'm really... Dennis Amos, of course, what am I talking about? So that's eight people associated with Warwickshire, plus myself. And as I say, Tim and Neil Smith 2 days earlier. So I hope Warwickshire members and supporters feel they'll get a decent amount of value out of the nostalgia and the various chats. In fact, who said nostalgia isn't what it used to be?
Thank you for listening to the Chamber Podcast. To hear more episodes, find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Audioboom, or go to the latest news section of www.greaterbirminghamchambers.com.